So the reading is from Matthew chapter 4, first 11 verses. Then Jesus was led by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. He fasted 40 days and 40 nights, and afterwards he was famished. The tempter came and said to him, "If you are the Son of God, command these stones to become loaves of bread." But he answered, "It is written, one does not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God." Then the devil took him to the holy city and placed him on the pinnacle of the temple, saying to him, "If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, he will command his angels concerning you, and on their hands they will bear you up, so that you shall not dash your foot against a stone." Jesus said to him, "Again it is written, do not put the Lord your God to the test." Again the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their splendor. And he said to him, "All these I will give you if you will fall down and worship me." Jesus said to him, "Away with you, Satan, for it is written, worship the Lord your God and serve only him." Then the devil left him, and suddenly angels came and waited on him.
If a certain pill could make you suddenly and permanently smarter, would you take it? No. Anyone know the science fiction story Flowers for Algernon? I was reading it during the week. It's about a little mouse. Anyway, I'll let you go and Google Flowers for Algernon, which deals with this particular dilemma. The truth is that you'll never have to decide that, because no such pill exists, and you can all be as dense as you are for as long as you like, and as far as we know, there is none that actually works anyway. But what's more important now is that there is a new series of studies that have been printed that talks about how to increase the IQ of yet unborn children. So if you're planning to have more children, here's a way to have children with a higher IQ. And this is part of that whole human genome project, which has been going on for a number of years. Now, we're not yet at a place where we can customize our offspring in terms of how high their IQ will be. But as I said, there is significant research toward that goal, and it's happening in China, in BGI Shenzhen, which has some of China's top biotech institutes and some of the best DNA sequencing machines in the world. And there is a man who is in charge of that whole setup, himself an IQ prodigy. His name is Zhao Bowen, and he's using the machines to crack the code for intelligence. And he has just produced a paper saying that within a decade, he believes that they'll be able to boost the IQs of all Chinese children by as much as 20 points. Within a decade. Now, okay, having read that, it said to me, that's all right. We'll be able to have smarter children. But here's a question I'd like to pose for you. If they're more intelligent than we are, will they be able to make better and more wise choices than we do? Will they still think that we have enough national parks? Will they still watch The Bachelor, Big Brother, or Channel 7 News? And this is huge, given what we've just shared a few moments ago. Will they be able to resist temptation far better than we do? We suspect that the answer is no. Sometimes super smart people use their intelligence only to come up with far cleverer rationalizations for yielding to temptation and doing the wrong thing. And last week I mentioned, and I mention again, that famous verse from St. Paul, where he says, "I do not understand my own actions, for I do not do what I want, but I do the very thing I hate." There is a particular blog called Loon Pond, and Keith Miller, one of the writers on the Loon Pond, wrote yesterday, and it arrived in my inbox late last night, this particular piece, and he says, "I write about our national leader." He says, "Temptation is a strange experience for me. I want to be God's person, but I also have some deep human needs for approval, affection, and the satisfaction of strong physical and emotional drives. When wrestling with a specific temptation, I seem to change into a different person inside. I have a kind of tunnel vision and only see the object of my resentment, my greed, or my lust. All else is blotted out. I am no longer the smiling, friendly Christian, but instead am an intense and sweating stranger, yet not a stranger, for I know this stranger so well. Reason waits outside the door of temptation for me. I argue against my conscience and dazzle myself with agile rationalizations about parks and everything else. By that time, the battle is usually lost." Even more to the point, think about another character, Jesus. If anyone was to have a kind of typo-free DNA, it was clearly to be Jesus. But our text finds Jesus in the wilderness, as it says, tempted by the devil. Now, admittedly, the things he was tempted to do are not the kinds of things that would tempt us. We don't have the ability to turn stone into bread, leap off the temple without injury. As someone at 8:15 said, with my bad leg, I couldn't even get up the temple. Or command the kingdoms of the world. But there's no reason to think that the enticing power of the temptations that Jesus received were any less than the temptations that are ours. And the writer of Hebrews puts it in this way, "For we do not have a high priest," referring to Jesus, who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, "but we have one who has been tempted as we have been in every way, yet was without sin." Whatever our IQ, temptation is a part and parcel of the human condition. And that's why the 13th century Franciscan monk known as St. Anthony advised all people, "Expect temptation with your last breath." So another question to pose for us. Even if higher intelligence could immunize us against temptation, would that be a good thing? Certainly the petition in the Lord's Prayer is, "And lead us not into temptation." It would seem to suggest so. But the account of Jesus' temptations makes us really wonder. In fact, could Jesus have accomplished what he did without the struggle in the wilderness? Could he have done what we call the will of God without first confronting the tempter? Now, in Matthew's version of the story, the whole point of the temptation is to Jesus experience a wedge driven between himself and God. And the outcome is the fact that that wedge was not driven between Jesus and God is the point of the temptations. Now, it's very instructive. Now, I was talking to Margaret before the worship. The Greek word which is translated for us, tempted. Some of the translations we have in our Bible are most difficult indeed. You know that the today's English version, the Beatitudes, has blessed. Today's English version, for example, has happier those. Happy for us is not the same as blessed. But time passed, it had a different view. Now, the word used in the Greek for tempted is the word perazo, which carries the idea of testing, scrutinizing, and disciplining. And of course, that makes sense, because if there is a test, in order for the test to be successful, it must be something that can be failed as well as being passed or endured. Otherwise, it's not a test. So the text has Jesus led up by the Spirit to be tempted. In other words, suggesting here we have the true testing, where it is part of creating our moral core. It can show us the strength or the lack of our commitment and our values. And as Christians, we need to be able to distinguish between being tempted and yielding to temptation. We started off at 8:15 singing that song, which I'm sure you could all join in with me, even if we didn't have the music. Yield not to temptation, for... Next line. Just shows you what a sinner gainer is, because she knows all the lines that follow after. It's a fair request. But given that temptation continues to come to us, the petition really is shorthand for, when we are tempted, help us not to fail the test. Doesn't suggest that no more tests. What's more, if we could actually eliminate temptation, we would close down one of the roads that leads to our own development and our own spiritual development as well. And if temptation is a road, then it definitely has forks in it. And the nature of temptation is that the particular forks along that road force us to make decisions. Will we go this way or will we go that way? Will we follow the leading of the tempter or will we follow the leading of God? Sometimes the pull of temptation is so demanding that the choice of turning at a major intersection is almost all we can see. And sometimes it's a matter of small choices. It's always when we have lamb roast, for example, and it's cooling before it's served. If someone goes out of the room, I always have to just lift up and check that it's properly cooked and so on. I've yielded to temptation for 43 years and I've succumbed every time. These are little things. They do not lead us to, unless I eat too much of it, ungodly destinations. The problem with temptation, though, is that we don't get to make just one big correct choice and the battle is won, as if I can fix that, that's it, completely. Read in isolation, this story seems to suggest that that's the way that Jesus functioned. But when we read Matthew, we find out that that isn't the case. We have to keep on deciding afresh, albeit in a whole range of circumstances, whether we will be the one that God calls us to be, or whether we will be something or someone else. And it can at times be hard to see where we're standing at the fork, but we're actually fulfilled when we make choices that demand our best. Now, we may not be tempted by things that tempted Jesus, but at root, our temptations have a commonality. To mistrust God's readiness to assist us in facing the particular trials that are ours. Paul says, God said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for power is made perfect in weakness. The thing is, we need to ask God for that grace and power, not only at times when we come to the small forks at intersections, not only at the onset of temptation, though it is certainly important at moments like that, but also beforehand in our regular life of prayer, which is no doubt why one of the few specific petitions that Jesus included in this model prayer is, lead us not into temptation. It's something we say often, but similarly, we do not always give thought to where we are going. As Christians, as leaders, as whomever, we are continually faced by temptation to be less than whom we really are, to be less than the kind of person God has called us to be. How will we follow in that? Lent is the time when we prepare ourselves in reflecting on temptation, our whole being, as to whether or not we are God's people and how we might become closer to God, so that the experience of the crucifixion and the resurrection enables us to see clearly ourselves as children of a loving, caring, redeeming, forgiving Father.